Welcome to Indie Author Answers, a podcast about the craft of writing and being an indie in the world of self-publishing. Each week, we'll read a chapter from an unpublished novel and critique it. To read along with the show, go to indieauthoranswers.com. To follow along from chapter one, go to jimheskett.com/part1. Or to get a recap of the first half of the story, go to jimheskett.com/recap. Now, let's get this mother started. So here's your host, Jim Heskett.
Hello, hello, all my beautiful friends. How are you? How was your last week? Mine was good. It's actually been a while since I recorded, and if I'm being totally honest here, I'm just getting this episode in right under the wire in time for publication because I had some computer problems, and I used to build computers, and I used to love troubleshooting and reconfiguring components and all that crap. Now I really hate it because I just don't have time for it anymore. And it was like I had massive computer failure, and I thought I had all these hardware problems, and I was going crazy because I like blew several evenings trying to get this fixed. And finally, I was just about to give up and go all Mac, you know, because I have a PC for my main desktop computer, and then I have a MacBook Air. So I was just about to say, you know, F Windows, I'm done with you. But then I reinstalled Windows, and everything seems to be fine so far, at least. Anyway. Welcome to the Indie Author Answers, as the British guy already told you at the beginning of the show. How are you? I'm well, thanks for asking. I won't waste a whole lot of time up front with all the chitty chat. I think we're going to have a relatively short episode. Longtime listeners of the show know that, though I used to say that all the time and then would be proved wrong because I would find excuse to ramble about this and that, but I think we're going to have a relatively short chat. We got a short reading and a relatively short tip of the week. So our tip of the week this week is actually I'm going to do a three-part segment of tips. It's the first time I've done something like that. And this is part one of this three-part segment. And what it is I'm going to be reading and commenting on Elmore Leonard's 10 Rules of Writing. And I'm going to talk about the first three today. So here they are, the first three rules. I will read them, and then we'll go back and chat about them. Number one, never open a book with weather. Number two, avoid prologues. Number three, never use a verb other than said to carry dialogue. Now, I think you could look at all 10 of Elmore Leonard's rules and tune in next week and the week after for the rules 4 through 10. I think you could look at all 10 of Elmore Leonard's rules as saying, don't be boring, don't be cliched, essentially. And that's a quick way you could take them, but I think we can dig into these quite a bit deeper and explore them. Number one, never open a book with weather. I think you could look at this a lot of ways. He's saying, don't be boring, don't be cliched. Start off your book with something interesting, something that tells a story. And he's really saying you don't need to make that rookie writer mistake of thinking that you need to start off your book with setting the mood. You don't need to tell us about the town where your story takes place or the kind of weather that day, whether it was stormy or sunny. None of that really matters. What matters as right off the bat when you start your story is character and plot. That's what really matters right off the bat. Mood, that kind of thing, you know, show us the mood instead of telling us the mood. Don't tell us that it's dark and stormy. Show us that it's dark and stormy by showing us a character who's in strife, a character who wants something, and something immediately stands in that character's way. So starting off with, it was a dark and stormy night, is that old cliche that you, and it's basically telling rather than showing. You're trying to tell the reader how to feel about the story by trying to paint a picture of the mood. And it's not necessary, it's not effective, and it doesn't get the point across, so don't start with mood, start with character. Speaking of that, rule number two is avoid prologues. Now, I know that this is, for the last several years, prologues have waned in popularity, at least that's from what I hear. I've used them in a couple of my books. But in traditional publishing circles, at least back when I was querying and trying to find an agent, that was what was on all the traditional pub writers' boards was, oh, don't put a prologue in the beginning of your book. If you put a prologue, an agent won't like it, which that's stupid. But the reason I think that they don't like prologues is one, the prologue by definition is something that is apart from your main story. Now, it would either be set in a different time, you know, like outside of the main time frame of your story from a point of view that's not typical to the main part of your story. It would be something that's separate. And so the lesson here is, if you're telling something that's not your story, why would you start with that? You know, you don't want to start your story with a big chunk of backstory explaining what the world is like. You know, show us what the world is like as in chapter one, as we're seeing character and plot develop. You don't want to start your story with something that isn't your story. I use a prologue in my book that's coming out later this year called Sallow City. But the reason that I use a prologue in that story is because it's from the POV of a character who doesn't get another POV character, doesn't get another POV chapter throughout the book. So I thought that it was okay to make it the prologue because it's not really backstory. It is actually the beginning of the story. It's from the POV of a mortuary technician. And right away, you know, on page one, he interacts with characters who are important to the story. So it's not something that's separate or takes place a long time before. It doesn't spend a lot of time setting up things. It gets right into the story, but because it's different from the rest of the book, I did make it a prologue. There was one book, I can't remember the name of the author, and I'm not going to go to the trouble of looking it up, but there was one book I read. It was a mystery series, and the book was in first-person POV, but the prologue was a journal excerpt from a character in the story who dies before chapter one. So we see in this prologue some of this character's thoughts and feelings in this journal entry, and then a lot of the book, the main character who's in first-person POV is piecing together and learning things about that. So that's kind of interesting because that, even though it's kind of exposition-y, it still gets the point across and it's intriguing and it sets up a nice mystery. And if you're going to do something like that, have, you know, if your book is in first-person POV, you can maybe get away with having a prologue and an epilogue in a third-person POV. Those, I got to tell you, books that I read where it alternates between first-person POV and third-person POV, they really, really annoy me because it feels like cheating. You know, you have some chapters where it's all, I did this, and then it's the next chapter and it switches to another character's POV in third person. Just like, I think you gotta play by the rules. Anyway, I'm rambling here. All right, Elmore Leonard's rule number three, never use a verb other than said to carry dialogue. This is one that I agree with about 98%. The only times when I don't use said is when I'm using a dialogue verb to indicate volume. Like I might say shouted or whispered or muttered, but I would use those very sparingly. You know, you might find two or three uses of whispered in 50 or 60,000 words of my text. Because I think, you know, for a large part, you can communicate tone and volume just in the words and in the action beats that are surrounding it. And I think that the intent of this line is to say, write better dialogue. It's to say that if you're using something besides said to carry dialogue, it might be a sign of weak dialogue. You know, and he talks later about using adverbs to modify dialogue. If you're saying, don't go in there, he warned, that is, it shows that you're not secure that your dialogue, that your line of dialogue is going to get the point across. One, so it's insecure. Two, it's overriding because in the dialogue, he warns them not to go in there. And then in the dialogue tag, you use the word warn again. So it's overwriting, and which I've talked about that many times. You cut down on overwriting. Anytime you can use one word instead of two, you absolutely do it. So the lesson here is use said, write dialogue that conveys your meaning, and trust your reader to understand what's going on. And that's all I have to say about that. And next week we'll pick up with rules 4 through 6. I'm totes excited to talk about that stuff with you guys. And now we're going to get on with our reading. We have a relatively short couple chapters this week. We have a Miguel chapter and a Megan chapter. It's only 1,400 words across the both of them. And I'm going to start reading them right now. Here we go. Part 4, Chapter 6, Miguel. Miguel dug the spatula into the pan and laid a mass of fluffy scrambled eggs onto a plate. He added 2 pieces of bacon from the other pan and then gave the plate to Maria. They sat down at the breakfast table and Miguel opened the Cholula. "Hot sauce?" he said. She shook her head. "Thanks for breakfast," she said. "I've been eating too much instant oatmeal lately. This looks delicious." When she spoke, she didn't look Miguel in the eye, rather kept her gaze on the eggs. Miguel watched her eat in silence for a minute, and she never lifted her face from the food. Miguel doused his own breakfast with hot sauce. "What's going on? Is there something bothering you?" Maria tucked her chin, a move that Miguel knew to mean that she was trying to hide something. "It's nothing," she said. "Come on, Maria. I know when something's bothering you. I know how you're trying to hide your face from me like I can't see it. Please just say what's on your mind." "I saw the strangest thing the other day," she said. "Promise you won't get mad." Miguel set his fork on the table. "Whatever it is, you can tell me. I won't be mad." "I was at the liquor store the other day just picking up some wine for the book club meeting I go to on Thursdays, and I saw that friend of yours. The one always wears those dark jeans, you know. I think his name is Derek." "What did he say to you?" "Nothing," she said. "He didn't say anything to me. I was on one side of the store and he was on the other side in the checkout line." "Okay," Miguel said. "Then what was so strange about it?" "Well, he got into an argument with the checkout girl. Big fight, like everyone in the store stopped what they were doing to watch it. I didn't hear the first part, but they were fighting about the price of a bottle or something, and he started yelling, and the manager asked him to leave. They even had a security guard come over. Big guy, as big as you. I thought they were going to start punching each other, but the manager was saying he was going to call the cops, and then Derek just left." "Yeah, that sounds like him. What else happened?" "When he was walking out, he turned towards me and winked. I wasn't sure he was winking at me, but seemed like it. I didn't even know he'd seen me in the store. I was going to say hello to him, since he's your friend, but he got in his car and was gone before I could." Miguel thought about how best to phrase his response. Maria, for some reason, felt guilty about all this. He spoke softly. "He's not my friend, and he's not even a good guy. He's the kind of guy who would use you and not think twice about it. He's not a guy you should be messing around with." Maria dipped her head down and shoveled a fork full of eggs in her mouth. "I'm sorry. I know I should have told you sooner," she said. A note of paranoia hit Miguel. Would Wilds hurt Maria to get to me? Miguel reached his hand across the table and placed it on top of Maria's. "Hey, it's okay. You don't need to be sorry because you didn't do anything wrong. I'm not mad at you. Just make me a promise. Just stay away from him, please." "Okay, Miguel. I stay away from him." Thoughts raced through Miguel's head and a realization came to him that he needed to set a plan in motion. He thought back to the conversation he'd had outside the Larimer Lounge before he went inside to find Carl. Theo had been so upset about the likelihood that someone might hurt Maria. Maybe Miguel needed a backup plan in case somehow he was unable to take care for Maria any longer. "What do you think of Theo?" he said. Maria averted her eyes, hiding the blush on her cheeks. "Oh, I don't know. He's nice," she said. Chapter 7, Megan. After returning from Bear Peak, Megan said goodbye to Becca and spent some time sobbing in the Chautauqua parking lot. After a few minutes, she realized she had tracked mud into her car and went outside to eradicate the brown paste. She got some strange looks at the trailhead parking lot, crying while scraping the utility knife along the sole of her boots. During the drive home, her prior conversation with Brian played on a loop inside her brain. What he said, what she said, what she should have said. Megan compared the analysis from her sister, Hayden, as well as from Becca. two diametrically opposite ways of looking at the situation. Old Megan defenses began to kick in as she tried to justify and rationalize the situation, which lent to Hayden's viewpoint beginning to feel more appealing. The moment of clarity she experienced on the mountaintop faded away. Get angry and let the endorphins and adrenaline bury the pain. Yes, I'm married, but that's my business, not his. And for him to become so righteous about it, well, that's just narrow-minded. In the end, for a short-term obsession, why should he care so much? Did he actually think that there would be some love connection? Or is he just mad that I'm unavailable and he didn't know about it beforehand? The more Megan thought about it, the angrier she allowed herself to become. By the time she arrived at her house, she had worked herself into a fury. Her hands ached when she released the steering wheel, and now she just wanted to fight with someone. When she opened the front door to her house, and there inside sat Wilds and strung-out minion Alex with a pile of methamphetamine on the mirrored coffee table between them, she had found her victims. She walked right up to the table and dropped her purse on it, sending a fine mist of powder into the air. "God damn it, woman," Wilds said. "Watch out, this is serious shit here." "Didn't I tell you I don't want that crank shit in here? Talking to you is like trying to talk to a cat. Do you understand English? This is my house, you stupid little slut. Screw you, it is. This is my house. But it won't be anybody's after the cops raid it because of your stupid macho gangster crap. What do you think Chris will say about all this when he gets home? How do you think Chris is going to feel about all these drugs and all these ghetto people you're always having over?" She turned to Alex, seething. You're Brian Connolly's roommate, right?" "Yeah," Alex said, hunching his shoulders, trying to make himself a smaller target. Did not work. "You can tell that judgmental, self-righteous asshole that his concept of morality and his Buddhist interconnectivity horseshit isn't the only view that matters. Just because he believes something doesn't make it so." "What the hell are you talking about?" Wiles said. "Perception isn't reality, it's fucking perception." Megan snatched her purse, creating another meth cloud in the wake. She stormed off to her room and slammed the door behind her. Inside, alone, she dropped to her knees and pulled the lockbox out from under her bed. Vibrating with resentment, she entered the 4-digit combination to open it and took out the card with Walker's number. She ran her fingers over the top of the soft white business card. It would be so easy. One phone call and he's done. One phone call about the weed in the basement and I'll take him away and I won't have to deal with this anymore. One phone call and then the house is mine. On her phone, she dialed the first few digits of the number. Then she remembered the arraignment, the jury trial, and the witness protection. Nothing about it would be simple or easy as she had pictured. Her finger grew heavy. She could not continue. What am I supposed to do? Through the door, the sound of Wiles shouting. A crash. More shouting. Something like a struggle out in the living room, and then pounding at her bedroom door. Okay, so that is part 4, chapter 6, and part 4, chapter 7, Miguel and then Megan. And I think what strikes me right away about all this is that it seems like a tale of two chapters. Because we have one chapter that contains a lot of errors, that first chapter. It even has a sentence that has that's so grammatically poor and has so many typos that you probably noticed me stumbling over it as I was trying to read it. And I'm not going to correct it. I'm going to post it up on my blog at indieauthoranswers.com just as it is so you can get a feeling for it. Like, it seems like that would have been something obvious I would have caught in editing. You know, or a professional editor would certainly catch it, or a beta reader should have caught it, or I should have caught it when I was reviewing it. But apparently I didn't. And there is a whole lot of a dialogue, like or paragraphs that have an action beat, then dialogue, and then a dialogue tag. And if you have an action beat and you have a dialogue tag, one of those is unnecessary. Because if you start your sentence with an action beat and then you finish it with dialogue, or you start a paragraph with an action beat, then you have dialogue, you know who's speaking. It's the person doing the action. It would always be the person doing the action. So the dialogue tag, he said or she said, is not necessary. So contrast that with part 4, chapter 7, and we'll get into more specifics here soon. But part 4, chapter 7 is a very intriguing chapter. I think it works great. And it has a great ending. It has a nice buildup of tension. You know, it starts off recapping what happened before, and then the tension builds and builds, and it ends with a beautiful cliffhanger that, you know, if you were really following the story closely, you could probably guess, you know, what the struggle in the living room was and the pounding at Megan's door that happened at the end. But it's exciting, right? Because I know that in the next chapter, we're going to back up in time a little bit and see things from someone else's POV that lead up to that. And so that's exciting. I'm excited to read that and critique it next week. Anyway, so let's go back and look at things in a little bit more detail. In chapter 6 of Miguel. So we start off with some very very banal description here of Megan. Or not Megan. The other one. The other M person in this story. Miguel. Or one of three. Miguel, Megan, Maria. There's way too many M's. Way too many names that start with M in this story. So Miguel's making breakfast. And I don't actually mind that it spends two sentences describing him making breakfast, because it really puts you right there with him, you know, and by the end of the second sentence, we know that he's with Maria. So we know that he's digging a spatula into a pan, he's laying things on a plate. So even though we don't know where they are, we can assume that they're at a house, you know, they're probably not at a restaurant if he's spooning the eggs himself. So I don't think it's necessary to say Miguel stood in his kitchen digging a spatula into a pan. It's pretty well implied. So then they sit down and they just have some breakfast. And I'm pretty sure that this chapter, and I think that the next chapter, the Megan chapter, were things that were added in way later. You know, they definitely weren't first draft stuff. Like, I think in the initial and earlier drafts, Maria had almost no part at all. She was maybe hardly even referenced. But I wanted to give Miguel more to do in the story, and so I think I had to make Maria a bigger part because of that. So by the second paragraph in this chapter, we know that something's going on, and this is good. This is good to have conflict early, because if we'd spent six paragraphs of them just eating breakfast and chitty-chatting about this and that, it would have been incredibly boring. But by the end of the second paragraph, we know that Maria won't look Miguel in the eye, and she won't stop looking at her food. So Miguel knows something's up, so that's conflict right away, and that's good. Because it's a very short chapter, so we need to get into it. It's only like, you know, 700 words. So if you have a 700-word chapter and you spend the first 400 words setting something up, then it makes it kind of boring. We need to get into the meat right away, you know. Less fat, more lean, less gristle, more, I don't even know, this metaphor fell apart before I could even start. Anyway, so here we go. So they start, Miguel's like, you know, is there something bothering you? And then it says Maria tucked her chin, a move that Miguel knew to mean that she was trying to hide something. So we're starting to get, you know, I think that's okay, because he's like, is something bothering you? And then he gets more visual confirmation. We have more showing that that she's trying to hide something. But then in the next paragraph, when he says, come around, Maria, I know when something's bothering you. I know how you, your face away from me, like I can't see it. This part isn't necessary. We could have either had the description in the previous paragraphs or this. Because Miguel is just basically restating what was internal monologue for him. And this is something that could definitely be cut. So then we get into it. And so Maria tells him this story about seeing Wiles at the liquor store. And here's a bit of overwriting, or not overwriting, but poor writing, when she says, just picking up some wine for the book club meeting that I go to on Thursdays. Now, she could have just said, I was just picking up some wine for book club, and we would have understood what that meant. But when it says that book club meeting that I go to on Thursdays, that's bordering on one of those fiction sins where you see people say, as you know, the meeting is set for Thursday, you know, which is just providing exposition. Two characters should never talk about something that they both already know for the purpose of informing the reader of something, because people don't talk about stuff they already know. So it's not quite doing that here, but it's almost an as you know. It's getting pretty close. Anyway, so Maria tells the story that's kind of interesting about how Derek gets into an argument with someone. We can definitely see that, you know, Derek is Wiles. We can definitely see Wiles engaging in this kind of behavior, getting into an argument with a checkout girl, and then almost getting into a scuffle with the security guard. And then the interesting thing happens when he's walking out and he winks at Maria. So an astute reader would know how Miguel feels about his sister Maria and how protective he was of her way back in part one when she was dating Ray. You know, Miguel went ballistic on Ray when Ray implied that he might abuse Maria. So Miguel went, you know, crazy on Ray, cracked a beer bottle over his head. So just the idea that Derek Wiles might hurt Maria would definitely give Miguel a strong motivator to not only protect Maria more, but also to be more suspicious of Wiles, or to be more, to put up a bigger wall, to go after him, or do any number of things. You could see this could provide Miguel with any number of motivations, because as I've talked many times before, this book is all related to loyalty, and Miguel is an extremely protective and caring brother. He's protective and caring of lots of people, but especially his sister. And we got to see that with his reaction way back in Chapter 2 when Ray implied that he might sometime abuse Maria, and Miguel, you know, wasn't going to be having that. So he attacked Ray, and then, you know, later on in Part 2 of the book, he ended up killing Ray. Not specifically because of that, but, you know, it was one of his motivations. So in the beginning, when Miguel starts to think about this, it's pretty nice subtext. You know, he does say, a note of paranoia hit Miguel. Would Wiles hurt Maria to get to me? That's almost a little too on the nose. We could have just seen Miguel, you know, say, I don't know if you should hang out with him. It would have been implied that was Miguel's worry, that he would be worried that Wiles would try to do something to Maria in order to hurt Miguel. So it's not too terrible, you know, it does help drive the point home. So in then the end of the chapter, we have almost a really good bit of showing. It's showing, even though it's a cliche, where he says, you know, he's thinking about bringing in Theo to spend time with his sister so that she'll have extra protection. And he says, what do you think of her? What do you think of Theo? And Maria averts her eyes, hiding the blush on her cheek. Oh, I don't know. He's nice. And, you know, that's a little, it's definitely a cliched kind of thing, like, you know, the bashful, oh, he's nice. But it is a nice bit of showing instead of her saying, yes, I think he's cute. I think we would make a good couple. I think you should have him over more often and we can spend time together. That would have been telling. And now we move on to Chapter 7. So this chapter, you know, I was talking before in Chapter 6, if you remember what I said, you know, 10 minutes ago, I was talking about how you want to get into the action as quickly as possible in your chapter. There's that saying, you want to start as late as possible and end as early as possible, because if there's something at the beginning you can cut or the end you can cut, then it probably doesn't need to be there. And in this chapter, it does take a little bit longer to get going. Things don't really get exciting until about halfway through. We don't really see the conflict. I mean, we don't see the external conflict. There's a lot of Megan's internal conflict in the first half of this chapter, but I don't know if a reader really cares about Megan's internal conflict because she is such an unlikable character, basically. I mean, I think she's maybe gotten a little bit better as the book has gone on, but, you know, from the beginning she wasn't very likable, so it's, if you start off a book with an unlikable character, it's hard to win the reader over. You know, a very skilled writer can do it. Clearly, I don't think that the time that I wrote this, you know, 5 years ago or whatever, I was not skilled enough to do it. But it can be done. If you're a new writer, maybe don't try it until you've gotten a few hundred thousand words under your belt. Anyway, so even though it starts kind of slow, we get some nice recap because Megan did have a pretty significant event. So even though I don't know if this really qualifies as the sequel part of a scene sequel, you know, if you consider the scene when she was on the mountaintop and she came to this realization about how she'd been selfish and how she needed to change, well, it's not really a sequel here because basically what we see is instead of Megan having the breakthrough to where she realizes that she needs to be nicer to people, she slides back into her old behavior. And it even says it. Old Megan defenses began to kick in as she tried to justify and rationalize the situation. And really, I don't know why I tried to, I don't know why I did this in the story. I think that having a, like this kind of reverse character arc, It doesn't often work. I've seen it work in movies like Young Adult. Young Adult is a great movie to watch for storytelling because you see a character who tries to change, you know, a character who starts out as one thing, who has some experiences, realizes she needs to change, and then in the end, she doesn't change. That maybe that's a spoiler, but it's still a good movie. You should see it. Young Adult with Charlize Theron, Patton Oswalt. And it's really, really hard to pull that off. You know, it's as hard to pull off as making an unlikable character likable as it is, you know, doing this, having a character who could have an arc and then doesn't, and still making an interesting story. It's really hard to pull that off. So basically, Megan has this chance to change, and she decides not to take it. She decides to rely on her defenses, which basically, if you look at her arc over the whole story, it's just kind of been a roller coaster, up and down. There hasn't really been any kind of effective curve where you could look at Megan, you could plot points for Megan's development and say, here's where she was one thing, here's where she started to change, here's where she changed more, and here's where she became something else. There's nothing like that for Megan. But there is, and this is a little tiny minor spoiler, but I'll be vague, near the end of the book, there is some redemption for Megan. She has more story to come, and I think her story does get more interesting. At least it gets a lot more dramatic, and there's more to come for her. So she basically tells herself, fuck Brian, it's my business, you know, he can't become righteous about it, why does he care? And then so she's getting angry and angry. And this does this, even though this is all internal conflict, the fact that she's getting angry serves an external purpose because she comes home and she's furious and she wants to fight with somebody. She comes into her house to see Wiles and Alex. So they have some kind of pointless dialogue here where the subtext is all Megan is just, you know, angry. She's like, do you understand English? It's like talking to a cat. There is one line I really like after Wiles says, this is my house, you stupid little slut. And she says, screw you, it is. I don't know why, but I really like that line. Screw you, it is. This is my house. And I used italics to make sure that the screw you part is italicized. Otherwise, it would read like, screw you, it is. Which wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. And there should probably be a comma there. Screw you, comma, it is. No, actually, now that I think about it, no, the comma wouldn't make any sense. But screw you, it is, with the screw you. And I'm going to stop saying that because it's just kind of weird. Anyway, moving on. So then there's a line here in her dialogue when she's yelling at Wiles. That's kind of strange. But it won't be anybody's after the cops raided because of your stupid macho gangster crap. Seems like you could look at that like she's playing her hand. You know, because if there haven't been any reminders lately, but, you know, Megan had chapters previously where she found all the pot downstairs. She overheard him, you know, and walking around with a gun. Before that, she had the visit from Special Agent Walker, who said, you know, you got a rat on your brother-in-law. So in terms of arc, I guess Megan actually does kind of has an arc with that stuff about how she feels about Wiles, because she goes towards not liking him to being afraid of him, and then. So I guess with that kind of part of subplotty kind of arc thing is she going to do anything about it or not? Actually, now that I think about it, I don't know if you could really call that an arc. Her story is just so messed up and convoluted. It's even hard to make sense of who she was, what happened to her, and what she became. It's even hard trying to critique it. I can't make a whole lot of sense of it. The moral of the story there is keep your plots simple if you can help it. Keep your character arcs simple and clear. You can still have a story that's simple, that's interesting. You don't have to make your story interesting. You don't need a complex plot. You don't need lots of subplots and lots of characters and lots of things crossing over. You can be simple and be interesting. It's entirely possible. And The Problematic Virtue is a great example of making your story too complicated just ruins it, because even though there's a lot of exciting stuff that happens in this book, it's all just so crisscrossed. It's like the story feels like just like lines on a piece of paper, just crisscrossing, you know, lines drawn all over a piece of paper, and you're trying to follow different threads. Anyway, so then the interesting thing that happens here is so Megan shouts at Alex, "You're Brian Connolly's roommate, right?" And so this is an important thing to remember. She says, "You tell that judgmental, self-righteous asshole his concept of morality, et cetera, et cetera." And Wiles is like, "What are you talking about?" And Megan storms off. Now, Megan is so upset, she's vibrating with resentment, that she is thinking of actually calling Walker. And there's not – all it really says here is it says the card with Walker's number. I don't know if this is a good enough reminder of all that. It wouldn't hurt to maybe for her to reflect back on the day that she met Walker to get a little bit more of a reminder about it other than talking about the soft white business card. But she's very tempted to call it until she's almost about to do it, and she even takes her phone out and she's punching in the numbers, and we're really building up the tension here until she realizes everything she thought about before that kept her from doing it, you know, getting arrested or maybe going to a jury trial, having to do witness protection. It's not going to be as simple as she wants. She says, "What am I supposed to do?" And then the chapter enters with this really, it's a little bit vague, but it's incredibly exciting. The sound of Wiles shouting, a crash, more shouting, a struggle out in the living room, and then a pounding at her bedroom door, and then the chapter ends. Now, you might say that this cliffhanger is a bit of a cheat because it's so vague, but I still think it's quite exciting. If I didn't know what happened next, I would really want to know what happened next. You know, what's this shouting and then pounding at her bedroom door? What's going to happen to her? And to answer that question, you guys are just going to have to wait until next week, because that's all I'm going to say about this today. I'll see you guys in 7 days. Thanks for listening. I love you. Now here's the British guy.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I know, but don't be sad. We will be back. Please, don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher or wherever else you happen to have found it. I mean, wherever it was, they're obviously got good taste, so please rate and review it anyway. Also, we'd like you to check out our blog at indieauthoranswers.com. You can also, I mean, if you're up for it and you've got time, pop on over to jimheskett.com, and you can even sign up for the email list and you'll get free stuff. I mean, who doesn't like free stuff, right? Of course you do. So go on, you can do that as well. By the way, don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter at IndieAnswers, and you can like our Facebook page. And if you've still got time for that, then obviously you haven't got much time left for writing. And let's face it, that's what this is about in the end. So once you've done all that, why not go out there and write something? I mean, it's what Jim wants you to do. And if Jim wants you to do it, then you should really do it.